And I went, oop. That's all good. The following is an unrehearsed interview with Tim Brannon of Mays Lick for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview is being conducted at the offices of the, what's the?
Farm Credit Service.
Farm Credit Service in Northern Kentucky, in Maysville, Kentucky. I usually start these interviews by getting a little bit of background about the individual I'm talking to. So, won't you tell me a little about, I know you, so, you know, you were raised in the area, and just start us out like that.
Born in Maysville. I've always lived at Lewisburg. My dad's a farmer. I farmed for a few years with my dad. Later went to school at Mays Community College for 2 years. Got a degree in agribusiness and got my bachelor's with the University of Moorhead in agriculture. Graduated in 81. Went to work for Farm Credit in October of 81 and worked with Farm Credit since that time.
I didn't realize you've been with them that long. So you've seen several of the changes and, and things. Now, what's your current position?
I'm a loan officer, and that's just been recently changed. There's been a lot of reorganization with Farm Credit. People who were vice presidents are now branch managers, and branch managers are now loan officers. So it's been a lot of change in the last 5 years.
Okay. Is this considered a branch, this location?
This is considered a branch of Farm Credit Service.
Okay, and you're a loan officer with them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's review some of those changes the last 6 years since you've been with the group. Now, obviously, this is part of the whole farm crisis, I guess you'd call it. Relate some of those changes.
When I came in 81, the downturn in the farm economy just started. And I thought at that time that things were going to be tough, but I didn't realize how tough. It's lasted a lot longer than I think anybody would have anticipated. In 79, the peak of land base had just been reached in the area somewhere along for typical land, say in Mays Lick. Cropland, you're probably talking about $1,200 an acre, and since that time it's declined to a point now, some 5 or 6 years later, where the value typically of cropland is about $850.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take a fellow's financial statement and take off $400 per acre, you can see a lot of financial stress will be created from that. I had an awful lot of drop in people's equity during that time, and as a result of that, we've had a lot of stress and strain both on the individuals and Farm Credit Services too.
How did the Farm Credit Services, that's the current name now, where did that come from? What kinds of groups?
A merger of the Production Credit Associations and the Federal Land Bank Associations, and that was done, it began in about 1984, and in about 1985 it was completed by vote of the membership of both PCA and Federal Land Bank. It was done to promote stability among Farm Credit Services, since some of the smaller PCAs and federal land banks that had such losses from declining land base in certain areas, say in Iowa, land base at one time may have been $2,000, now they're $800 to $1,000 an acre. So they had lost a tremendous amount of money, and in order to keep the that portion of the system afloat, they merged so that they could use the capital of the entire organization. And the same was true of both PCA. The time span in which PCAs and land banks have differed a little bit as far as the amount of time they struggle. The PCAs are the short-term side of the business, so the problem surfaced a lot faster with PCAs than it did with land banks. Land banks was the real estate into the farm banking that we deal with, and the PCA struggled from about 1979 till about 84, while the land banks have struggled from about 81, 82 until present, and the land banks have lost a tremendous amount of money, far greater than the PCAs, because you have a lot more options with short-term credit than you do with long.
Okay.
So there's been an awful lot of money lost in that time span on both sides of the business.
When you made that distinction, PCA would they're more likely to do, or that they were more likely to do farm agribusiness type loans.
Farm operating, cattle, machinery purchases, small real estate acquisitions, just about anything that you could put on the farm besides real estate. They can even take care of consumer goods, washer, dryer, even that type of thing.
Okay.
While the Federal Land Bank dealt primarily with real estate purchases and rural homes, any residents in the county that would be outside the city limits of Maysville, they could purchase a house. So that was the major distinction. One just deals with real estate, and the other with everything that goes from the farm.
Okay. What about the situation of Farm Credit Services now? Still in the midst of the crisis?
Still awful bad. Right now, farm credit overall holds 2.2 million acres of real estate throughout the United States. Western Kentucky,
Are you saying that they, in other words, that's out of the hands of the farmers? They've had to take that back.
Mm-hmm. We own 2.2 million. The Farmers Home Administration owns about 1.4 million that they've taken by insurance companies. I would say maybe a smaller amount yet, maybe half million to 0.2 million. But an incredible amount of land's been taken back from the farmers throughout the United States. The worst areas that we have are Western Kentucky, Ohio, portions of Indiana. We also have Tennessee, but Tennessee, as with Eastern Kentucky, has stayed a little more stable because of the diversity in agriculture in those areas. The areas that have dealt with corn, soybeans, and row crop are the ones that have been hardest hit.
Some of your literature talks about how the Farm Credit Services are not a branch of the government and so forth, which is which I guess is what, you know, when they hear Federal Land Bank, they thought of the government.
It's a quasi-governmental agency, is what they call it. And our original beginnings started with funds from the government. In 1919, when the Federal Land Bank was organized, they borrowed money from the federal government, as did PCA a few years later when they started out. And since that time, the money has been paid back in full to the government, and the funding that we use now to finance our loan is derived from the stock market and the bond market. We're a blue chip stock, or have been, and the reason why we have had such a good record with our stocks and bonds is that the government has said that they will back our bonds, in essence, they haven't really lended their name, like a treasury bond says, with the full faith and whatnot, you know, of the federal government. Ours doesn't, but it's the government says, you know, we'll back the farm credit system, and it's quasi-governmental.
Okay.
And our rates have stayed about 1% higher as far as on bond cost than the federal government, which is really good for a lender to be able to accomplish, because it's usually higher than that. There's usually a larger spread in the amount that you would have to pay, because the investor looks at the stocks through risk. So historically, the investors have seen our bonds as less risky than other types of investments that they could make.
If the government wants to help farmers that have credit problems, would they coordinate through organizations like yours in some way, or?
Not necessarily, but here in the past few years, that has been the case. Farmers Home Administration is actually the arm of the government that deals with farmers and one of the lenders of last resort. If a farmer can get it from anywhere else, he's expected to. The Farmers Home Administration, however, no longer has funding since the Reagan administration to make farm ownership loans, and their farm operating loans are severely limited because they must have, I believe it's a rule now that they have to have at least two rejections from another lender in order to obtain funding through Farmers Home. So what they have shifted their emphasis towards is use of a guaranteed loan program, which says to a lender, we'll make, if you make this farmer a loan, we'll guarantee your loan up to 90% of the principal and interest, which means that the lender on his investment in the farmer, as long as he follows the rules of the guaranteed loan, will never lose more than 10 or so percent of principal and interest, which is a really good deal.
Right.
So they have shifted more or less from a direct lending to a guarantor type of arrangement.
And so they work with you in that capacity?
In that capacity.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's not that much direct involvement. There is a governor of farm, Farm Credit Board, which is appointed by the president. He appoints certain members to govern the FCA, which is our regulatory body that takes care of the Farm Credit Service.
What was that?
FCA.
Okay. Well, so, what's that stand for? Do you know, or offhand?
I ought to. Jimmy, I think it's what I'm here for.
FCA. And you say they're a regulatory body?
Yeah, they're just a regular Farm Credit Administration,
okay, Farm
which
Credit
is appointed by the president as far as people, and they oversee the bank. They do audits. They make sure that we're in compliance with the policies of the bank and make sure that we're not exceeding our charter,
okay,
such as getting into areas that we shouldn't
be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I see. As this contraction has occurred in the farm credit area, let me talk with me about your specific responsibilities now. You said that PCA used to do, you know, operating costs, you do real estate kinds of loans. Are you still involved in all those areas?
We're still involved in just as many areas, but so much of our time spent now servicing accounts that are in trouble, working with farmers to get the guaranteed loans, like Elwood Howe was here this morning, and he's the branch assistant for Farmers Home Administration, and we have a lot more involvement with Farmers Home Administration in order to work out problems. It used to be if you had a problem, you just say, well, go down to Farmers Home Administration and see if you can refinance your loan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not that easy anymore because they have no longer have the funding, so you have to service these accounts still and work with FHA to accomplish something. And so much more of our time is spent with taking care of problems than making direct loans.
I see. Tell me about, you know, a farmer comes in and obviously if he's got a problem, he can't make his loan payments. What do you see as the cause of this?
For a lot of them, it's not bad management or lack of effort on their part to pay the loan payment. A lot of it's been caused by bad timing. For people that invest were from about 1978 to 83 in land, automatically had a loss in own equity because whatever they bought has depreciated. And same way with the farm machinery or some of the other agricultural assets there for a long time. Combines, for example, were just a tremendous amount of depreciation. If you bought one for a few years, they would just drop off because there was no demand. Nobody wanted a combine, and same with land.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the problems with the farmer has been just bad timing. Another major problem
to the uninitiated, how does that relate to making your loan payments? Because the equity in land has dropped, they can't borrow against that to get operating expenses?
That's right.
Okay.
If their financial trend is bad, we look at five things from an Earned Farm Credit.
Okay.
That's the man factor, which is the individual's history of performance, how he's paid on his loans.
Man factor, it's interesting. Yeah.
Uh-huh. His repayment ability, which relates to his past history of whether he's made a profit or not.
Mm-hmm.
Security, whether he has enough collateral to cover the loan. Financial position, which is relates to his owned equity, whether he has a high owned equity or a low owned equity.
Mm-hmm.
As far as his risk-bearing ability, and also scope, which means the term of years, the type of interest rates, the conditions under which the loan needs to be made. So all those five things have to play a part and work together in order for us to make a loan. We need to see all those five things meshing together to make a good loan. And if an individual's owned equity has a sharp drop, that signals that you may have some problems. And with the drop in land values, there has been a sharp drop in owned equity, you know, that's beyond their control. So
really all several of these factors have been affected by nothing that the farmer has done. His securities collateral obviously declined, and his owned equity, and you know, his payment ability. Of course, my research primarily is on tobacco. While we're on these ideas, of course, tobacco has always been an important crop in this area. How did that factor in to a loan in the past, and how does it relate to today?
We still look at tobacco as the chief income producer on a lot of farms.
Mm-hmm.
We generally each year use an earnings statement. We use the past tax years to show what his tobacco income has been. Then we look at his tobacco base that he's expecting to have for the coming year, or whether he plans to lease any tobacco, and figure it at the support price from the last year, and use that as a guide to see whether he has enough income to service all the expenses that he's expected to put in the crop, service his family living, and generate a profit to take care of his loan principal that's expected on the payment.
So if you're calculating on a support price, then the amount of income then has actually dropped in the last six years.
The tobacco has really suffered from a decrease in price and tobacco base. The tobacco base is off from what it was at about 79, 80 by about a third. So this had a tremendous effect on farmers' income, and there's really no way to recoup that easily for a small farm, because tobacco is a labor-intensive crop that a small amount of acreage can return a large amount of income, and once it's reduced by a third, there's really no substitute available. You can't get it from corn, you can't get it from peppers, cabbage, or anything you want to grow around this area that a lot of people try to shift to vegetable crops to make it up with these peppers and whatnot, and look for different ways, but nothing that you can grow in this area really return you the amount of money per acre that tobacco will.
And from the viewpoint of a loan officer, if they come in and say, well, I'm planning this much money on peppers, you don't...
We would look at it, but we realize that that's not really a solution, because most vegetable crops take a lot of experience, and you don't have too much success for the first few years on a new venture like peppers, or some fellows are growing zucchinis. There's all sorts of interest in other vegetable crops now, but it takes, like anything, you don't take a tobacco farmer for 30 years and stick him growing peppers and expect the fantastic results.
Well, plus you can't count on, there's not a support price, you can't count on an actual income. If you say that a lot of your time now is taken care of servicing existing accounts, obviously you're in sometimes an unfortunate position that you have to foreclose on someone. What kinds of steps? Obviously, you say that you try to refinance is one thing. What kinds of steps go into that process?
We take a look at the individual as far as his earnings now, his financial position, and review the entire loan and see just what the fellow's standing is right now. And based on that, we try and make a recommendation. And not always is foreclosure the answer for some individuals. Sometimes you might say, instead of refinancing, why don't you try and get an outside job or partial liquidate some items that you don't need. Say if you have, if you're over-equipped now for what you work, if you have a 100-horsepower tractor and you've gone out of the grain business, you don't need a 100-horsepower tractor, so readjust there and try and do some things that will trim down the operation and make you more efficient. Sometimes you kind of work with FHA for guaranteed loan, restructure loan on terms. Say if the fellow's down to the last 10 years of his federal land bank loan, we can reschedule it up to 30 years again, which mm-hmm. makes a lot of difference in your payment.
Sure.
Same way with the PCA. If the fellow's had an operating loan and that he's not able to pay, you can restructure it over a period of time instead of calling it due in 1 year's time. So there's several things you can do. It just depends on the individual, whether it's going to make a difference in his operation, whether he will be successful after, because there's no use keeping an individual in an operation that's losing money, because it may be losing us money, and if it's losing him money, that's no good either.
Right.
So you might as well call a halt to it. But there's not that many things that you can do to work out some of the situations. Sometimes you're just severely limited, because if the income's not there, there's not much an individual can do.
Of course, you have a vested interest in not foreclosing too, because some of these loans were made out on land values that were greater than they are today, and you'd rather see someone pay it off,
right,
from a profit viewpoint.
That's right.
What happens when you do foreclose? In most cases, you have an auction, you try to sell these things privately.
We give them a choice if we can. We would much rather see that the items are sold privately, because historically, if things are sold at public auction or absolute auction where someone is being forced out, the price that's obtained for those items is a lot less than you would normally. So.
Right.
We usually try and have the people sell it at an auction, but just through their own arrangements, not ours.
This office services how big an area now?
We cover Lewis, Parcher Lewis, Mason, Bracken, Robertson. We don't go across the river, that's a separate region, but we do take care of those.
Is Fleming not part of your area?
No, Fleming is in another area that run by Trippy Clark.
So in your area of those like four counties or something like it, how many foreclosures do you see, and how many have you seen, say, in the past year?
That's shifted somewhat too. On the federal land bank, loans in trouble over a certain amount of time, 90 days, are transferred to an entity of Farm Credit called Capital Corporation, and they deal primarily with loans that are in trouble, and they work out either a liquidation or restructuring or stuff on that. PCA still has to handle all their servicing while land bank does. Overall, foreclosures really take a long amount of time. So as far as seeing one on the horizon with some of the new laws, Chapter 12, or they have rights to appeal on the farm credit.
Right.
I would say maybe three overall in this office during a year's time.
Since you brought it up, I'll go ahead and mention it. Chapter 12 is a new piece of legislation, relatively new, and I kind of watch the Lexington papers and see how many. I think there was one in this week for the, I guess that would be most of this part of the state. There haven't been any chapter 12s in this area yet.
Not in this area. There had been in Carlisle. That office there, they've had, I think, three. And Carlisle has a few more problems than Mays office does. But they've had several since then.
Now, chapter 12 will only, for some research in the future listening to this tape, as I understand it, it's a way to refinance your loan based on current equity as opposed to what the equity was or what the value was when the loan was.
It's really heavily based on the appraised value of the individual's assets, the land, his machinery, cattle. And what the court does is if the individual owes $150,000 on $100,000 worth of collateral, they'll say that $50,000 is set aside for the next 3 years, and the individual has from then on just to take care of the amount that is against the property at that time. The $50,000, if they show a profit during the next 3 years, some amount of money is allowed to go towards that $50,000 reduced to that. But if nothing is shown over and above what the normal cost of the farm operation are, there's nothing really set towards the $50,000. It's just eliminated after 3 years.
Okay. Okay. Are you all expecting this to happen here?
We have one. I was thinking of why you mentioned it, that I had slipped my mind, but there's one in Lewis County that's taken it. Chapter 12 does have some areas that wouldn't suit some people, and that is that you have to have the income necessary to service the debt.
Yeah.
And some of these individuals are taking Chapter 12 now that don't really have the repayment ability. So it's just actually forced off foreclosure for a little bit longer.
Just to go back again, most of the you're dealing with loans that went back 20 years. Are those kind of people having much trouble? Is it just this 79 to early 80s group?
It's pretty wide and varied, but where you see the majority of the problem are the younger farmers or the farmers that have invested during the 78 to about 83 area when land values were high. The vast majority of farmers still have very high owned equity. I think nationally it's something like 80% owned equity, and the average farmer has $250,000 owned equity, which is pretty high. And they say overall the net worth of the farmer has only dropped 2 or 3%. And I would guess that's true because a lot of the landowners, my father for one, is established, and he's been established for 30 years, and he doesn't borrow any money. And you'd be surprised to the number that borrow no money at all, and I would say that would be somewhere in at least a third of all the farmers had no need for any type of lending at all.
I was going to ask you about that. Do you get very many people that own the farms that come in to borrow operating expenses? Or?
Not that many. On occasion, it just depends on what type of operations they have. Mason's a very varied type of area as far as it has dairy, tobacco, has a lot of industry comparatively to some of the other areas, which allows part-time farmers who don't really need to farm, but do it just because they want lifestyle. So the area doesn't lend itself to necessarily having to have operating. Tobacco farmers traditionally have been pretty heavy on barn operating during the summer and paying it back at the end of the year. But the number that our tenant farmers have decreased, and they have been the big area as far as for farm operating during the summer months. So
are you not dealing with very many tenants then much anymore?
A few. The last president that was here, which was Mr. Mump, was from Virginia, and he said he was surprised to see that there was any tenant farmers in the state of Kentucky because he had just migrated to Kentucky to take the position here as president. He said that in Virginia and West Virginia, along those areas, the tenant farmers were gone 20 or 30 years ago, and that he was really
just
surprised.
A remnant of the past.
Yeah.
This is side two of a tape with Tim Brannon of the Farm Credit Services. You were talking about the diversity of farming here and the part-time farmers. You know, this is not any profound statement, but we've seen farmers getting older. Is that that's something that you see here?
That trend is probably on the increase more than on the decline, because the young farmers that were in it are saying, you know, why should I go to the trouble of struggling through this? Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's fewer and fewer farmers that are of young age. The times have just eliminated them.
Sure. Let me talk about that. As far as you do, obviously, you know, there's still people coming in. You said you had a closing after this interview. How does a person get credit today? I mean, is there, there's not too many people that do you, do they, are they mostly sons and daughters of farmers, and do you require co-signing most usually, or?
On young people, that's quite a common practice to have a co-signer, because what you see in a person age, say, from 21 to 35 even, you see owned equities that aren't quite up to par. We'd like to see about a 50% owned equity. Mm-hmm. And that's after the loan's closed, which is really not easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
So the young person really doesn't have the size that you would need. You know, they're sort of small. They might have a net worth of $25,000 and maybe asking you for 10 or 20 to get some sort of farm venture, which is throwing them even further in debt.
Right.
So it's awful hard to do anything with young people unless they do have some sort of co-sign or that you can work something, guarantees or a new thing that we're trying to work for some of the younger farmers that want to buy farms or get some of these projects, but it's not easy.
In this time period we've talked about before, it seemed to me, and maybe back in the 70s, there was quite a bit of boom going on in agriculture, and there were a lot of people going into agribusiness type things, hatcheries over in Lewis County, and pig operations in Fleming County, and so on and so forth. Has that just about run its course, or what happened to that, those large, grandiose plans that...
We had one that was Licking Cork, and it had something like 10 prominent area farmers in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sow operation that was to be an investment for them under a subchapter S that would allow them to retire, was the so-called end of the project. But along the way, something went wrong. Hog prices went down, feed costs went up, and these fellows had a large amount of net worth, and I'd say 70% of them took bankruptcy. They had to by the time the project was ended. So a lot of the grandiose plans, or at least the one that I was associated with, was a real fiasco. It was just ended in disaster for all of them.
Obviously, though, when you know when it was looked at on paper and in the planning stages, everything looked like it worked out. Mm-hmm. As far as it was, because of the unpredictability of prices and
the interest rate that these fellows had plugged in at the time when the project started was, and I think it started about 77, 78.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at the interest rate. And up to that time, the interest rates had been fairly stable. I'd say anywhere from 6.5 to 8%, somewhere along that. And they computed the rate
that's
six.
What we're cost.
Mm-hmm. And along the way, the rates got up to as high as I think here at PCA we were 16.5 at one time, and that was when the rates at the bank were 18 and 19%. So we stayed under, but there's no way that you can survive an 8% error in your calculations of interest and expect to survive. And it wasn't really these fellows' fault, but it was just a combination of that. And the same way with the overall plight of the farmer. It's not been just one thing that's conspired to hurt the farmers. It's been bad weather over the past 3 years here in the county.
Right.
Interest rates have been higher in the last few years than they had been any time previously. Commodity prices have been cheaper during that time period. It's just been a combination of things.
Let me deal with, before I leave that, the young people in farming. In other words, there's just really, there aren't really very
there's not very many people that can go out and want to buy a farm and make a living off of it, no. Unless they've got something behind them or
going. Either they have to have an outside job or someone that'll give them some backing to get into it, to lend some stability to the operation.
I see. When you're looking at a farm to lend money against, and of course, as you said, it makes it a little easier because you really need co-signing and lots of own equity. Where does tobacco fit into the value of that farm? You know, it used to be that real estate agents might figure that tobacco poundage was worth $4 or $5 a pound on the value or something like that. There's no such formula anymore.
There may be through other lenders, but what we primarily look at in our appraisal of the farm, we use comparable sales first, and that's where you take a farm that is sold or several farms that are sold in the general area of the farm that you're interested in. Say if you looked at a farm at Mays Lick, you take three similar farms that are sold in Mays Lick in the last few years or a year or two and use it to compare to this one, and you sort of extrapolate the changes, the difference in crop ground, the difference in size, the difference in location, and use that to come up with a figure on the value of the land, and then add back in the value of the buildings. And that's one way to do it. There's also a cost approach where you can take the value of the buildings minus depreciation and then add in the value of the land. Also, there's income approaches, and that's where the tobacco would come into play, where you figure the value of a farm, the value of the income from a farm, and divide it by a certain percent. 8% is general what we use. Say if the tobacco on the farm was 10,000 pounds at $1.50, that'd be $15,000. You figure 8% that farm would be worth $187,500, or you use a certain percentage, and that sort of determines the value of the land. Because from an investor standpoint, if you weren't a farmer and were just an investor, if you said, well, in looking at this farm, looking at the income that it'll produce, it'll return me a certain percent, or I'm looking for a certain percent return at least on this property. And that's how you would go about it. You take the income and divide it by the percent return you'd expect, and that would be the amount that you'd be willing to invest in a particular property. So it establishes a bottom end of the market. At very least, this property would be worth this because it'll return me so much money for my investment. So that's where the tobacco would come into play.
Okay. I wanted to run through some of those problems that you see, and you know, of course, they relate back to you directly because you're helping these farmers try to stay alive. And the government's role, what is both on the credit end, I don't know if they could do anything, and then also from just the regulation of farmers, how has the government either contributed to the problems or helped solve them?
Well, not so much in this area, but in other parts of this district. During the 70s, the farmers were encouraged to go to grain, and you'll see this a lot in Ohio and Indiana and Western Kentucky. Operations that had been corn and hogs, or corn and feeder cattle, or corn and whatever, where they took the corn from the farm or the grain or whatever type of grain they raised and fed it to an animal or livestock and used that to increase your income by feeding it to the cattle. Well, it got profitable to where that instead of feeding it to an animal, you would just bulldoze out the fence lines, forget the farm buildings. You can go through Ohio and see all sorts of buildings deteriorated. Nothing there, and no fence. And so when the government said, let's boycott the Russians and not sell grain to them, that didn't help anything, and that messed us up sort of in the world picture as far as sale of feed grains. And I guess we're in a world economy now. As far as on grain, it's hard to compete with the Australians on wheat and a lot of different things. But once you build out those fences and let the buildings deteriorate, you can't really afford the investment to go back in and put them in because you've decided to make your operation more profitable by feeding animals or hogs. So they've had their part. We've had our part, and the farmers
So they geared up to produce grain, and now that it's no longer profitable, they
have no choice.
Yeah, they're overinvested the other way. They can't reinvest.
Well, they've destroyed buildings and investment that was there before to have another type of operation. They've lost the diversity. They no longer have the ability to do some other things planned.
Although tobacco is important in this area, and as you said, you look at it as the primary source of income, farmers are fairly well diversified, aren't they? There's a lot of dairy operations.
Generally, there's dairy, beef. We've seen a little more increase in hogs here lately. Sheep has made a comeback, not as much in this area, but as in other parts of the eastern Kentucky, there's been a stronger emphasis to grow sheep. So it's an area that's able to be a little more diversified. There's some corn and soybean operations in the area, but there's an awful lot of diversity that you can find in the area. The thing that's helped keep this area as strong as it has been from the standpoint of land values and repayment ability of the farmers to keep the land has been outside income because of the industries, Brownings, East Kentucky Par, Walls, Jockey International, Mars on the Hill, and a lot of part-time jobs for the farmers' wives doing this and that.
Right.
So that's contributed to keeping the area.
So we've had like a 30% increase as opposed to, of course you're familiar with these other places because you're all part of the same system where they've had a 50% drop.
Yeah.
What about the government's role in the tobacco program? Of course, you're interested, I know, because your family's involved and I guess a little interested here too. What do you see that situation as going and how does it relate to you?
Well, eventually I think the tobacco will no longer exist because I can't see the government continue to push no smoking and the health consciousness that it's tried to the last few years and continue to support the tobacco income as well. What I see, or what I think will happen, and I don't know if this is right or not, but I think that tobacco will eventually be phased out, that the government, I don't know if there's any organized plan to do this, but that over the long term, say the next 20 years, just keep shifting tobacco down as far as big income producing crop, and eventually the loss in the interest of the farmers give them a time to adjust over a period of time to other operations, dairy, beef, whatever else that they might want to get into.
In other words, they might have like a buyout plan like they did with dairy, or
I don't see buyout, but I see just
just letting it die a little bit,
just a ever increasing decline. Just we're not going to support it, the price will keep going down and there'll be less interest. The base will keep to continue to decrease, and eventually it'll die off.
How does that relate in any way to, of course, lending institutions that have that in the back of their mind? Well, how does that relate to
the profitability of tobacco right now? If they were just to cut it off, it would be tremendously damaging to all the financial institutions, maybe because you eliminated the income of the farmer, a large portion of it. Whereas if they take it over a period of time, it won't be so bad because you'll have time to just, farmer can get a job out elsewhere. He can shift his operation to dairy, or he can shift it more to beef, or he'll have some adjustment time. And I think the farmer is pretty adjustable and able to cope with a lot of change if he's given time. And I think if he gets that time, he can do all right still, but it's going to be an adjustment period for farmers, just like it has been all over the United States. I don't think we're going to have much an easy road.
Right. What do you you go out to look at these comparable values and so forth? Because there are already people that were on the fringe of where tobacco was making a little money, and now it's not really worth doing. People that you're talking about, like part-time farmers and so forth. Or people that were raising their own decided, well, it'd just be just as well for me to lease it. Are there, as you look at these farms, are there farms actually going out of, obviously some things we have farms that maybe have only 8 or 10 acres that are decent, or less than that, you know, that they could grow tobacco, and that's about it. Are there farms actually going out of farming, you know, or there?
There's being less done on them, I think, is a big part of it. Less maintenance. You don't keep fence up. You don't mow as often as you should. Instead of mowing once every year, you mow every year or two, you know, maybe.
Just to clear it out.
Yeah, and I think a lot more leasing is going on. So, well, you know, we just lease instead of grow it myself. There's been a lot of that type of thing going on. The competition for a lease is still very intensive, even though the lease that you pay is just almost like spinning your wheels. You're paying 55 cents to lease crop, and your production costs are almost enough to eat up any profit you would get out of it. So.
I was going to ask you to mention that. I guess you have to look at that when people say, I'm going to produce this much income, but
it doesn't make any difference.
It's a no-win situation there.
You could produce, you know, you just turn the dollars and you're not really generating any profit off of it. So why do it? Yeah.
What about the future of farm lending institutions? You said that right now the situation is still, you're still in the middle of it.
I think there's going to be a continuing large amount of change with farm credit because there's going to be less and less farmers to service. So there's got to be some change made. The number of farmers has decreased, I think it was 4% just a few years ago, down to about 2% now.
Yeah.
And so you're eliminating an awful lot of numbers of people that need the services.
Yeah, you don't have as many potential customers.
No.
As you said, a lot of people that are staying in, if there's no new farmers, some of these people are eventually getting out of trouble or they own their operations.
The reason why Farm Credit was organized in the 1919s with Federal Land Bank and PCA, their need is not the same as it was in 1919. The reason why we were chartered was because of the depression that farmers weren't able to get any money. And that's just not the case anymore. There's an awful lot of sources of credit with insurance companies. The banks have been deregulated. They can get into a whole lot more different areas that they hadn't before. And I think we're going to continue to shrink and have to shrink with farmers and have just as many pains and problems as they do.
That's why you all, I see, you know, on the chalkboard above your head, ask about insurance, the cost insurance. You're getting into other kinds of areas. You talked about different sources of income for farmers, but new farmers really are out of luck most anywhere, and local banks are much more conservative even than a farm credit institution. You're really servicing two different markets, aren't you? Or?
Well, part-time and full-time farmers. And the part-time farmer is the way of the future, I think, and maybe the way that farm credit will be able to survive. What I think will happen in this area, like several other areas in Kentucky that are industrial, you'll see more smaller part-time farms that are more or less just for lifestyle more than anything else. They'll have an outside income, piddle on the farm with a few beef cattle or maybe a little bit of tobacco, and you'll see less of the full-time farmer. And either those full-time farmers will be large, very large operations, or they'll be part-time. And I think you're going to see that break a lot clearer over the next few years, say 10 to 20 years. It's going to become real evident, I think.
Well, I was referring to also to the lending institutions. They're really, I mean, they don't get the same kind of customers you do because of their demands as far as down payments and those kind of things.
Yeah, it's our biggest competition is State National Bank, and they've been an aggressive bank.
More aggressive,
Security Bank up the street has always been very conservative. Mm-hmm. Bank Mays was a very conservative bank. Cumberland doesn't really deal with any farm loans, and neither does Buffalo Trace.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the largest lenders in the area. So in FHA, and FHA's more or less out of funds. So.
Right, I see. Maybe to conclude, of course, you were a farmer, and were raised on a farm. Is Are you one of those persons that would like to do that as a lifestyle, or?
Eventually, I'd like to get back to the farm.
To the farm.
But, sort of like lemmings rushing to the sea. You know what's going to happen, but you still want to. It's just a great lifestyle, and I have an awful lot of fond memories being on the farm, and I don't think there's any other life like it. You can really enjoy them.
I guess that's where the only farmers are going to be. I mean, there's obviously people aren't being trained, you know, new to be farmers. Mm-hmm. They have to have that kind of in their blood, I guess.
Yeah.
I lost my thought there for a minute. Oh, I was going to ask. We talked about the pork operation that was kind of an agribusiness type operation.
Mm-hmm.
We still have a lot of farmers in the area, and there's a lot of farmland, but business really hasn't come into the market. What's going to happen? Farmers are getting bigger. Is it just going to be big, very big family farms?
In this area, you'll see a greater tendency towards that. As far as large commercial farms in this area, I just don't see it. The land doesn't lend itself to that type of enterprise. The land is ridge land, crop land. The places you'll see that will be Indiana and Ohio, where you can have these vast amount of acres that you can invest in and see a certain amount of return and go at it if you're efficient. And I think corporations will push towards that.
Mm-hmm.
Here, it'll be the families that have held the land will hang on to it and pass it on to their sons.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have an opportunity to mm-hmm. acquire a piece of the neighbor's land who's maybe not done as well, I think you're going to see a bigger shift towards that. Larger family-owned farms here don't really see much potential for
the
really company-type
farms.
Farms
right.
And then also you'll see a lot of small part-time farms because a person is able to pay a lot more for a small amount of land than he is for a large amount of land. So they'll be able to out-compete them on that scale.
And as long as a dairy operation, for example, because you have to have lots of dairy operations close to the centers of population, they will continue, you think, to be fairly profitable and make it.
I think the dairy will do fairly well as long as dairy is divided into milk sheds, and that's government controlled too.
Is it? Okay.
So these milk sheds protect different areas. So it keeps like from Wisconsin comes to Louisville and dumping their milk. As long as we're able to protect our markets, we'll do fine. But, and a matter of fact, most of the South is kind of milk deficit.
Right.
As far as they need more milk than they can actually get under the present.
The way the sheds are set up. I guess the fear I want to know what your attitude was that, you know, eventually we might see farming disappear in the area.
Mm-hmm. I think you'll see larger family-owned farms and then the small part-time farmer tracts, and I think you'll see a large increase in that because if you look throughout the county now, you'll see some of this going on now. Owens Pike, out of Lewisburg, you'll see these 11-acre tracts with nice homes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guy says, well, you know, why spend $4,000 for a lot when I can own 11 acres for just a little more?
Yeah.
I think that's the direction we're heading.
I appreciate you talking to me.
All right.